Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As a listener to this podcast, you might often fantasize about your ideal cabinet, who you'd have as Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, Chancellor or Home Secretary. But have you ever had that thought, but with beer? Thanks to our friends at Beer 52, you can create your own cabinet of beers. You get a free case of 8 craft beers, and all you have to do is cover the postage of £5.95. So go to beer52.com/party, that's the word beer, the numbers 5 and 2.com/party, and get your free case of 8 beers. And you can arrange them however you like. You can create a cabinet, or depending on your political leanings, a shadow cabinet, or just leave them in the cabinet. And of course, the joy of a Beer 52 monthly subscription is that you can have a reshuffle every month, which would still make it more stable than most of the governments we have in the UK. It comes with a magazine and a snack, and if you don't like dark beer, you can choose the light option. You can pause or cancel at any time. So if you want to bring some stability and you don't fancy a reshuffle, you can indeed lead by example. Go to beer52.com/party and pay £5.95 postage to get all this now. Hello and welcome to episode 200 of The Political Party. Although some of you noticed this when it was episode 100. I'm not sure this actually is episode 200 because in the early days I miscounted one of the episodes. So welcome to episode 199, episode 200 or episode 201. I'm not quite sure where in that is. One of those three is right. But welcome to the show anyway. It's a landmark show. And as you'll know from seeing the name of the guest on your iPhone or whatever you listen to this on, a landmark guest, a true trailblazer in global politics, the first and only woman to hold the positions of Deputy Prime Minister, Prime Minister and leader of any major party in Australia. Julia Gillard was Australia's Prime Minister from 2010 to 2013 and had an incredible experience leading that country, dealing with her own party, dealing with the individuals in her own party. Now, you may have seen the documentary, The Killing Season, made by ABC in Australia. You can see that online. Julia's fantastic autobiography, My Story, tells the ins and outs of that story in detail. We cover some of that here. But I also wanted to ask Julia, and it's the same as when Tony Blair's been on, and the same with Nicola Sturgeon, anyone who's led a country, just the lessons and the insights of leadership, of the priorities you choose, the way in which you do the job, the philosophies you bring. And there are some really good, genuine, practical things that Julia did as leader for herself to effectively keep her leadership on track, I guess, but to just keep that focus of what her leadership was for. She now chairs the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London, and she's a visiting professor there. So I began by asking Julia, now that she's a professor, whether she has to wear long robes and a floppy hat.
If it does, then I've been doing it all wrong because there's been no robe wearing or floppy hat wearing. I am actually the chair of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London. That's the thing that they get me to do, which I'm delighted to be doing because it was an idea I pitched to King's College. I came out of my political experience with all of these kind of questions whirring around my head about how much of what I lived through had been, you know, the temper of the political times in Australia, how much was about decisions I'd taken, and how much was simply because I was a woman. And so I wanted to further the knowledge base, the research base around gender barriers and leadership, how we perceive women leaders, how we even define this thing called leadership. And so I came to King's College as a visiting professor and said, what about we create this global research institute? And fortunately, they agreed to. So we've been up and running for a few years now, very invested at the moment, as you would imagine, into looking at the gendered impacts of COVID. And I'm delighted to announce that we've got a sister institute underway at the Australian National University. So an Aussie-UK research partnership.
And just in terms of what the Institute is set up for, obviously it provide resource to advance the cause. But is there any element of it that is practical? Do you have any aims to literally train female candidates for office?
We're not in the female candidate for office training business, though there are some organisations in the UK and around the world that focus just on that. We want to be really practical. So when we say research, we don't mean, the stuff that you would only find in the digital equivalent of a university library. And if you didn't have a pass card to the library, you'd never be able to get it. We're talking about action-oriented research, which gives very practical strategies for change that people can put into effect in political parties, in businesses, through government policy to make a difference.
And you mentioned the gendered impact of COVID. You published Essays on Equality last year, which is a brilliant series of essays about that very subject. And one of the points you make at the start is that the immediate impacts of COVID may be negative for women, but its long-term legacy may not need to be. So what are the opportunities, may feel like an inappropriate word, but what does COVID do that might spark some positive change?
I think COVID has given us an opportunity. I know that feels an odd word, but an opportunity to build back better and to build back differently. And so amongst the ways in which I think we can do that, one is using the technology that we're using now that everybody has relied on to get them through. So many professions, so many lines of work have gone virtual, and people are doing things now in flexible and remote ways that they'd been told in their workplace before that they could never be done like that. I've had dozens of conversations with women who have said to me, for years I've been pressing for flexible work and they've always told me it's not possible. And look, here we are doing it. And if we take the best of this with us, not the fraught lockdown, homeschooling, all the rest of it, but the best of this with us, then I think we could restructure not all workplaces, but many workplaces in a way that's more gender friendly. But we have to be really intentional about that. I'm kind of worried that if we just drift into the future and people say, well, look, for office-based work, you can now work out whether you come into the office or work from home, that we'll end up seeing that the men go into the office, the women predominantly work from home, the women will be less visible. Come promotion time, the men will be the ones that stick out as, you know, taking the next step up the ladder. So we've got to think very carefully about merit, how we measure it, how we define it, how we include people who are working virtually and remotely. But that's one really practical example. Another practical example, I think, is we spent a lot of time clapping for carers, applauding those who work in the NHS and comparable health system organisations around the world. But we really have an opportunity to systematically revalue caring work, which has been underpaid and under-recognised for far too long. And that is, in my view, because it is disproportionately women's work. So let's rectify that inequality.
And when you reflect on your time in office and you say you tried to come to a balanced judgment about how much of your experience was just about the tone of Australian and global politics at the time, how much of it was to do with the agenda. Do you have, not that you think of it as 66% one thing and 34% the other, but do you have a kind of view of how much of it was down to your gender?
I can't break it down in percentages, no, because the things are so interconnected. You know, the longer we governed, when we did big controversial things, for example, we put in place an economy-wide emissions trading scheme. You know, Australians vie with Americans for being the most carbon-intensive people on the planet. That's not exactly a race you want to win. So we were trying to restructure our economy to help deal with climate change. And, you know, that would have been a big controversial policy, whoever was doing it. It had been big and controversial under male leaders. But the fact that the gendered insult became the go-to weapon, the fact that I was stereotyped as someone who was uniquely unable to pursue this agenda because I was obviously out of touch with family life because I don't have children, you know, subtext, what sort of woman decides that she doesn't want to become a mother? You know, all of this was conjuring with sexist tropes. And so it's hard to put a percentage on it because it kind of came across as all of a piece.
Some people might look at, you know, women leading any country and say it's clearly harder. It's clearly harder to get elected. It's clearly harder to stay in office. Are there unique pressures in Australia? You know, some people might say, you know, there's a stereotype view of the Australian male that perhaps, I don't know whether it's based on anything, you know, factual or not, but is Australia perhaps a harsher climate for a woman to lead than, say, Britain? Or in reality, is there very little difference?
I think in reality, there's very little difference. I know that there are probably all sorts of stereotypes about Australia formed from, you know, Crocodile Dundee movies way back when. And then, of course, the most common conversation you ever have about Australia overseas. Oh, my God, you've got sharks and snakes and spiders. It's like, yeah, but they're not jumping out at you in suburbia. You don't have to worry about this. When you come and visit post-COVID, it will be fine, let me assure you. But no, I don't think that there's a uniquely Australian factor here. I think that, you know, these gendered incidents are common around the world, and I feel reinforced in that because one of the things that I've spent my time doing is writing a book with a great friend of mine, a Nigerian woman who's now been elected as head of the World Trade Organization, Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. And we've interviewed 8 women leaders from around the world. We've looked at the global research base on women and leadership and interrogated this question about how much is culture and context and how much is common. And we found that women, even from nations as different as the UK and Liberia, have got experiences in common simply because they're women.
The sharks and snakes in Australia, mostly to be found in politics, not in the suburbs. you had to deal with a few in your time.
Well, I don't know if that's a gendered experience. I think politics always has a bit of that involved, whether that's the UK or Australia. I'm sure if you were interviewing Theresa May right now, she might have a story to tell about the rough and tumble of politics too.
One of the things you say in your book is the importance of purpose in leadership. And you literally wrote your purpose down effectively in a letter to yourself. Firstly, that was something that Alan Milburn suggested that you do. And obviously listeners in the UK will perhaps know that, along with John McTurnan, Alan Milburn is another prominent Labour figure who served in the cabinet here, who ended up being a close advisor to you.
That's right. I met Alan Milburn because he was coming and going to Australia and helping with some strategic analysis for the Australian Labour Party here. And he, in my view, is a fantastic thinker. He's got a fine mind, and he's the sort of person who can challenge you to lift your eyes from the day to day and to scan the horizon and think about the biggest picture issues. And he did that for me when I was Prime Minister. He rang to congratulate me and he said, look, I know it's absolute bedlam. You're under extraordinary pressure. You've got a million things to do, but carve out time to write down on a sheet of paper your sense of purpose, the purpose of the government you lead, and keep it with you, because it will really, you know, help clarify and steady you on difficult days. And he was absolutely right. And it's a piece of advice I've retailed ever since, giving him full credit for it. I haven't just pinched it. I always say that it was Alan Milburn who gave it to me first.
I mean, it's the sort of bit of advice that, you know, other world leaders, other prime ministers might think, I'm not going to write my purpose down. I'm not, you know, I'm not a school kid. I don't need to write down a mission statement. But it's probably something that more world leaders should do.
There's something enormously clarifying about you and a sheet of paper, or you and a blank screen if you're working on a keyboard. You know, because we all think, you know, I'm very clear on my values. I'm very clear on what I want to achieve. And you probably have discussions like that with your nearest and dearest about what you want your life to be about. But there's something about reducing it to writing that makes you think through the specifics of it. You can't get away with, you know, just the kind of generalist, you know, airy-fairy, fluffy kind of phrases. You've got to get clear. You've got to get specific. So I would recommend it to anyone. And I don't think it is a sort of school kid exercise. I think it's an incredibly challenging exercise as an adult.
And how often would you refer back to it?
I kept it in my handbag, and all of the women listening now will go, yes, and then there would be the transfer of handbag to handbag thing, and that can be very complicated. Yes, there was the transfer handbag to handbag, and it grew increasingly tattered and all the rest of it, but I did get it out on difficult days. And I reproduced it in the first book, My Story, which is my story about my time in politics, my reflections on that. Obviously, the book I've written with Ngozi is of a different order. There are some of our own experiences in there, but we're really trying to work out whether the things that the global research base tell us about women and leadership hold true in the lived experience of world leaders. So that's why it's called Women and Leadership, Real Lives, Real Lessons.
And did you have a philosophy about how you were going to be a leader, as well as your political ideology and a programme for government and policies? Did you think, well, I'm going to, you know, obviously you'd had the experience of being in the Gang of Four in Kevin Rudd's government, and that has strengths and weaknesses. Tony Blair was criticised for having a sofa-style government here. Did you think, right, I'm going to reinvigorate cabinet government and I'm going to make sure that I talk to certain caucuses or certain individuals on a regular basis? Did you have effectively, quite aside from the political programme, a plan for leadership?
Yes, I did. I did want to reinvigorate our cabinet structure. I did want to get more method, system, pre-planning into our decision-making. You know, we needed that, in my view, and I did bring that style to it. I've always been a pretty methodical person. I would hope people would say that about me. And so I wanted to bring that with me. And I wanted to bring with me a culture of respect and a welcoming in of opinion and people giving the best of themselves. I think one of the things that's actually quite hard to achieve in a cabinet is we have this unusual status of the Prime Minister being kind of the first amongst equals. But if a Prime Minister in a cabinet debate speaks early, then it gets hard for others to put a different view without it starting to look like they're somehow challenging the leader or it getting uncomfortable. And so always picking your moment about when to speak, whether to speak, how to shape, how to let run free debates so that you get people's genuine opinion, not them saying what they think you want to hear, but what they really think.
And in terms of managing your time as a leader, as Prime Minister, so many leaders, so many politicians become bogged down in the day-to-day. The job starts to run them and they find it really difficult to raise their head above the day-to-day kind of distractions and frustrations and arguments of politics. How did you try and control your time and control your agenda when you were Prime Minister?
It takes enormous discipline to do that, and you don't always succeed. But I literally used to get up every morning and think to myself, you know, government's this bloody big machine. You know, the media agenda runs on its own cycles ever more quickly. And I used to get up every morning and think there's only two ways today can go. Either I'm running it or it's running me. And, you know, the constant struggle was the machinery of government. You had to run it. And I don't mean by that, you know, barking at people what to do, but you could, as Prime Minister, just sit passively in your office if you wanted to, and this machine that is government would just keep serving up things for you to do, and you would be a busy Prime Minister, and at the end of the week people might say you'd been a very productive Prime Minister, but it wouldn't be your agenda. You know, you've got to push the machine in a direction and say, I want you to deliver this. You know, we are going to do a national disability insurance scheme. We are going to make a profound difference to educational opportunity. We are going to do these things, and I want the machine to deliver that to me. And so you had to be directive about it. And then the media agenda, you had to intersect with it, obviously, but you couldn't get to the stage where your energies were completely consumed with trying to stay on top of or in front of, you know, a 5 minute, 10 minute, 15 minute media cycle, which is where we kind of are these days. You just needed to recognise that a lot of what happens day to day in the media is froth and bubble. It's not the big tidal movements underneath, and your job as a leader is really to be thinking about those big tidal movements underneath, not the chop on the surface.
Leadership reveals character, and it can find people wanting. People that people often presume will be great leaders, often when they achieve that high office, it becomes a burden to them. And people can think of, I'm sure, Australian and British and global examples of that in relatively recent times. You obviously saw what it did to Kevin Rudd, and it changed your opinion about his suitability to lead. How aware were you then, stepping into that role, of the need to, I suppose, behave in a certain way and to not look burdened by the office? Or was that not how you thought about it?
That's not kind of how I thought about it. I mean, one of the consequences of becoming leader the way I did, which was all in a rush and without warning, is I didn't have the opportunity to kind of brace for the weight. I'd had a very good insight into what being Prime Minister would be like. I'd been acting Prime Minister on many occasions, but I didn't have that run into it. I mean, you know, if you run for leader of your party, maybe you're leader of the opposition for a number of years, you run through the election campaign, you might win, you might lose, but you obviously think about winning. And so you think about that moment when the weight settles on your shoulders and you get ready for it. I didn't have that kind of get ready cycle. And so the weight came down, you know, hard and fast. And it was, you know, difficult to be under it. I'm not someone who, I'm a fairly even-tempered sort of person. I'm not someone who gets very het up or anxious or any of those sorts of things. So I think that calm in my demeanour stayed. I wanted to show some strategic patience so I could let a bit of the, you know, sort of froth and bubble go by and not react to it. And I wanted to try and focus on the biggest picture issues. But, you know, there's no way I could say to you, I got that right every minute. I mean, it's just impossible. But they're the goals you set for yourself. They're certainly the goals I set for myself.
You talk about resilience in your first book and the importance of that, as well as the importance of purpose. Where did you draw resilience and strength from during difficult times?
Well, being clear about the purpose is in its own way a source of resilience. You, if you know what you came to do, if you know what matters to you most, then that will help you even when the going gets tough. Second, you know, the best of my colleagues, and by that I mean not just my parliamentary elected political colleagues, people like Wayne Swan, my deputy prime minister, but also the staff who worked with me. And of course, we've got a friend in common, John McTernan, Mook, as I would call him. They became, you know, family, you know, a real bond. I mean, the emotional bond that you end up with each other because you're so much in the pressure cooker together, under fire together. It's a very strong bond. And for me, it endures with so many of those people to now. And that was a great source of resilience. And then your family, your friends, people who have known you for forever, who aren't reacting to you because you're the Prime Minister, but just because you're Julia, they really matter to you. And getting little bits of relief. You do have to carve out some time to just decompress, you know, read a book, go for a walk, watch a stupid movie, you know, that kind of stuff, to just allow your brain to, you know, reset. And fortunately, I'm always, you know, always been someone who's slept pretty well. I'm not the kind of person who's padding around the house at 3 a.m. worrying about things. And I'm a big believer that if you can sleep, that your subconscious is kind of grinding it out for you whilst you're asleep, and you'll often wake up with an answer you wouldn't have got the day before.
How hard is it to stay in touch with the public as well when you're Prime Minister? It's hard enough in any senior political role, but specifically as leader of a country, to keep your finger on the pulse of the public. I mean, that, you know, shows like the thick of it joke about having a zeitgeist tape that ministers watch. Did you think, I'm going to carve time out of my day just to make sure that I know what the football scores are or what's happening in particular TV programmes? Or again, is that not, was there not necessarily specifically a plan for stuff like that?
There wasn't really a plan for stuff like that. I mean, I think if you can stay in good touch with family and friends and you talk to them about life beyond politics, you know, the way I would manage my personal relationships is I never want to view that as clocking on for the night shift, you know, having done my job all day. If I was going to have a natter with a friend of mine on the phone, I wasn't going to be saying, oh, did you see what happened in Question Time today? I would be saying to them, you know, what are you reading? What are you doing? You know, how are you feeling about things? And they'd be the ones who'd say, oh, I'm watching this great new show, or, you know, reading this book, or something about the footy, or whatever. So you had that sense of normality. And in terms of the big trends in public opinion, often the armoury of politics is not your best way to get to them. You've got to still be able to lift your eyes to, you know, what's happening in the cultural sphere, what's happening in just the temper of community conversation. You know, social media was getting an increasing presence then, not what's happening with the political social media, but generally what are people interested in, and that will help you get a bit of a feel. And then, you know, you could have real conversations with people, but you'd have to find the moment to do it. I mean, no one's ever had a real conversation with the Prime Minister when the TV cameras are rolling. And even when the TV cameras go away, unless you deliberately let that person find some space to have the conversation with you, they won't, because they will be reacting to your status. Oh my God, I'm talking to the Prime Minister. Oh my God, I better not, you know, better not accidentally swear. What if I use a stupid word, you know? What if I say something really dumb? You've got to let them get through that by being as conversational and as casual as you can be. And then they'll start talking. And, you know, if you can then follow up what they're saying with some questions and get them on a roll, then people will often tell you the most extraordinary and personal things because they kind of think they know you. And it can be very revealing, not only about their attitudes, but about where people's heads are at in general.
How did you find dealing with the international community when you were Prime Minister, and how fit for purpose are some of the international organisations we have? Thinking firstly of the UN, there'd been a whole discussion after Iraq and Syria and Libya about how useful the UN was. How did you find it as a kind of organisation?
I wouldn't be there with a list of criticisms. I mean, could the UN be better? Yes, of course. Could the G20 be better? Yes, of course. And you can roll through the rest of the list. But at the end of the day, these are human beings trying to come together to do incredibly complicated things. And it's not easy. And that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be reform, but my intersections with many of those organisations were that it was productive, that it enabled me to meet with many other leaders, to conduct discussions on behalf of my nation, get to some conclusions, work through issues in common. So, you know, we should always be striving to do better, but we shouldn't discard what we've got now because, you know, the world would be a much poorer place without those things happening.
A lot of countries are reevaluating or trying to have a conversation about their history. Britain periodically reflects or fails to reflect it on the empire and the legacy of that. Australia obviously has its own unique history. Where is Australia as a country in its national conversation in regard to its own history? Do you think it's come to terms with it? Is it having that conversation, and sort of what should the nature of that conversation be?
I think we're mid-conversation, and we are much more in that conversation than we used to be, but we've still got a lot to go. I mean, if I reflect back when I was growing up, I mean, in my hometown of Adelaide now, I grew up here, you know, I migrated here with my family, came when I was 4 years old. I did all of my schooling just at government schools in South Australia. We were really not taught anything much about Indigenous history, you know, history started as far as it was conveyed to us with Captain Cook discovering Australia, and, you know, from there it went. And I see the education that my great niece and great nephew are getting now. Once again, they go to the local government school, and it's an entirely different education about Australia's history and our past, and the depth of their knowledge, even at the ripe old ages of 7 and 5, is you know, more than I would have graduated high school with. You know, they are much more steeped in it. So I think that's really important. We are having quite vibrant community conversations around racism, around our own National Day, Australia Day, and what should its future be, around reconciliation. So all of this is incredibly important, but we would be kidding ourselves if we thought we were at the end of it. We've got many, many more things we need to do and work through, but I think that there is a sense of progress.
One of the important landmarks on that journey was Kevin Rudd's apology to the Stolen Generation. Really emotional piece of television. Must have been really emotional to have been in Australia at that time. How symbolic was that apology, and what has the legacy of that been?
It was crucial, absolutely crucial, and a huge credit to Kevin that he did it and the way in which he did it, which was very thoughtful, a very thoughtful speech, a very thoughtful, you know, piece for history, which wove together what needed to be said, but with the personal stories that made it come alive. So it was a privilege to sit in the Parliament and listen to him give it. And you could almost feel the nation, you know, exhale. You could feel that people felt a sense of relief that it had been done, and that it mattered, and that it was going to be a foundation stone to take us to another place.
It must be. This is what makes politics so difficult, is when you have such admiration for someone when they do something like that, and it's hard. You can't take that away from Kevin Rudd. It's a huge moment. It's a really important thing that he did. But you must have so many mixed feelings about him, having worked so closely with him and the things that happened between the two of you. It must be quite hard to kind of come to a balanced view when you've had such a kind of Shakespearean relationship with another leader.
I mean, people obviously talk to me about all of this, and I mean, you know, here we are. It's just coming over 10 years ago now that I was sworn in as Prime Minister, and, you know, I don't spend my days, you know, looking back and running the what-if scenarios in my mind. Obviously, I draw on my experience. People ask me about them. I draw on my experiences because they help inform my contemporary thinking. But I'm, you know, a huge advocate for we, you know, what is in our hands is this present moment, and what can we do in this present moment? We can decide to change the future. And that doesn't mean that you know, we've just had a conversation about the need to look back, Australia to look back on our history, the UK to look back on our history. We've got to look back on our history with fresh and clear eyes, but for the purpose of building a different future. So, you know, my relationships in politics, whether they were with Kevin or with anybody else, I don't spend my time and energy on any of that. I look back with pride on the achievements of the Rudd Labor government and of the government that I led. But once again, I don't seek to be a raconteur on my past life. You know, I'm going to turn 60 this year, but I reckon I've got a few good decades in me yet. So I'd rather get on and do the things that will matter for me next. And I've got a wonderful mix, very associated with the UK. I'm chair of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership. I'm coming on in April as the incoming chair of the Wellcome Trust, which is a fantastic organisation and never more needed than it is at this moment in our world, given its historic focus on infectious diseases. And so those things keep me energised and pointed towards the future.
Just on the achievements of not just the Rudd government, but the Gillard government, education was a big thing for you, and education reform, things like publishing data and exam results and putting them in the hands of the public, very controversial in other countries as well. The Gonski report and education funding, needs-based funding. Now, these are things that the left has struggled with in various countries. Why do you think that is?
Education, the education portfolio is such a tricky one, partly because everybody thinks they're an expert. You know, when I was Minister for Education, I was Minister for Education and a number of other portfolios at the same time, but we had a huge education reform agenda. And it always used to, be amazing to me that you would be wandering around talking about education reform and everybody would think that they knew exactly what you should be doing because they went to school, you know. Yeah. So this is, and you'd think, well, if I was wandering around talking about brain surgery, people would be going, wow, that sounds really complicated. That sounds really hard. I could never do that. But you talk about school education, everybody goes, well, look, when I was at school, and off you go. It's difficult because everybody wants a slice of a say in the reform agenda. Now, that can be an enormous strength, but it can also mean that without shaping the debate, it can end up with a lot of squabbling. I think that there's, so much at stake for a nation and its values about how it educates its children. So it's, everybody in the community is involved and it's deeply important. And it's complicated. People like to wish away the complexities in education, but getting it right is complicated. In my view, it does start, though, with empowering those. If the community is going to be having this intense conversation, and I think they want to, empowering that conversation with real data so that it's informed, not about when I was studying mathematics way back when I was in primary school in the, 1970s, like who cares, to have the real-time data now so that we can say, where is disadvantage? What difference do the resources make, extra resources to combating disadvantage? What difference does the calibre of school leadership make? What difference was different styles of curriculum and teaching make, and answer those complicated questions so that we can make sure that we are achieving a great education for every child? And that's what we sought to do with my school, and it's sort of radical transparency so that parents and everybody interested could see how kids were going in a context of knowing the socioeconomic status of the children and in the context of knowing the resources that were being brought to the teaching task.
The default position of the left on education, as with any public service, is, well, invest more, raise taxes and spend more. But the nitty-gritty of that reform can often be very difficult. And taking money from, say, universities and putting them into schools that need them more sounds like a left-wing idea, but it can be really controversial on the left. Some people might say that's because a lot of people in Labour circles are quite middle-class themselves and they're looking after themselves. Why do you think the left has struggled with radical public sector reform like that?
Oh, I think it's a little unfair to say that the left has struggled with it. I think everybody has struggled with radical public sector reform. It's hard. But, in my experience, people on the left of politics broadly, so I mean in the Labor Party, but also people on the left of the Labor Party, yes, there's some, old-fashioned views amongst some that the answer to everything is to spend more money. But I think for a long time now, most people have been prepared to be pretty questioning about the efficiency of the spend. I mean, there's so much that you want to do if you are a believer in combating inequality and making sure that everybody's got access to opportunity and to the things that come with that. There is so much to do that a wasted dollar is really a crime. A dollar that could have worked harder is really a crime.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've come from the Left Caucus and you've got involved in student politics. What would the student Julia Gillard have made of the Prime Minister Julia Gillard's education reforms?
I think... I did come from the progressive, you know, from the left of the party. I was involved in student politics, but we were of that generation that was cleaning up the leftover mess after far more radical periods in student politics, and we were trying to centre union around proper engagement in education policy debates. So in that sense, I think my prime ministership and my young period as a student politician were actually very correlated, and the young Julia Gillard would have said, yes, you're getting that right. Of course, I changed some views along the way. The Labor government had introduced the higher education contribution scheme, so an income contingent loan scheme. My young self was a believer in completely free education. I now understand and came to understand on my political journey just how much the higher education contribution scheme had helped us create a far more mass tertiary education system with much more opportunity. So on that policy issue, I changed my mind. And on, you know, I would have, as a young person, said, look, the only schools that really mattered, the ones that I wanted to focus on, were government schools, and sort of independent and private schools could look after themselves. By the time I was education minister in Australia, it was true to say that whilst there are some very elite private schools, there are many non-government schools which serve quite you know, ordinary working families, even disadvantaged families, and we would not be fully addressing disadvantage unless we looked at the circumstances of those schools. So that would have been a different view to my younger self.
And they serve them through bursaries and kind of an assisted places type thing, do they?
Look, we've got such a different system to yours that... So it's not a comparison with, you know, your very posh schools that posh people go to. We don't do posh, you know, we're Australian. In Australia, overwhelmingly at primary school level, and you know, in the upper reaches of secondary school, it gets a little bit more equal. But most kids go to government schools, so they are funded by a mix of Commonwealth and state funding, but they are run by state governments. Then we have independent schools, private schools, where parents pay fees, but every private school in the country receives some government funding, and the amount of funding that it receives is correlated with the socioeconomic status of the kids in the school. I could go through many, many layers of complexity, but that's the sort of broad brush picture, which means that it is viable in Australia to run a school with very low fees that, you know, serve families that are prepared to put a few thousand dollars a year into their children's education. It is viable to do that because you will get some government funding. You'll get it. You know, if you're serving disadvantaged kids, you get a lot of government funding. And so it means that, you know, very ordinary working class people will put many of them, not all of them, obviously many of them use the government schools, but there will be categories of working class people who scrimp and save so that their children can go to one of these private schools. And they are not wealthy kids. They are not wealthy families, certainly not by the standard of the posh schools in Britain. They are not people like that.
This can be hard enough anyway, having this conversation in Labour circles, but you were running a minority government in coalition with the Greens and some independents. The Greens are one of those parties that I think, and I'd be interested to hear what the Australian Greens are like, but certainly the British experience is, the public have a view that the Greens are kind of nice people and they care about the environment and they're genteel folk and they wear sandals and they eat tofu, right? Then you meet some Green Party members and you think, oh my God, they're the angriest people I've ever met in my life. This is completely different. Is that the same with the Australian Greens? And how easy were they to deal with?
I agree with you. I mean, in this sense that I don't agree with every stereotype you've just laid down, but I agree with you in this sense that people often think to themselves, you know, the Labor Party, the Tories, or in our context, you know, the Labor Party, the Liberals. These are proper political parties filled with, you know, ruthless machine people. And then there are the Greens, and the Greens are kind of something else. You know, the Greens are another political party, and there are obviously political professionals in them who are prepared to play their politics just as hard as any political professional you'd meet in any other party. So you wouldn't want to instantaneously put them in the naive camp as if they are somehow qualitatively different to everybody else who's a participant in parliamentary politics. In my experience, they're not. But having said that, I had respectful and good relationships with the Greens leaders that I dealt with, Bob Brown, then succeeded by Christine Milne. We had very different perspectives on things. We would discuss those things through. We would agree where we could. We would disagree if we needed to. But it was never done in a context of, personal irritation or anything like that. If, you know, I've felt that as a human being, I often felt a lot of support from them, for me as a human being, even whilst recognising that our politics was quite different and the things we were trying to do would often be different.
Often leaders are defined not just by the people that they work with, but by their opponents. It's impossible not to think of the people that you face across the other side of the floor. You know, that's how it is. And Tony Abbott is one of those people that, in a way, your legacies are kind of intertwined, and it reflects better on you than it does on him, perhaps. And your speech on the floor of the House is one of the great political speeches of the last 100 years, and it's become kind of your calling card. When you call him out for being a misogynist, it's an amazing speech. How does that feel to kind of have that as almost, that's almost like an album. That's like your sort of big hit that you're known for. I mean, is that, given the things that you care about and your experience, I suppose in a way that there's something really cool about that and really important. But do you often think, well, I've got other hits, you know, I'm known for other stuff. Try some of the B-sides.
The aging rock and roll star who's trying to do their new innovative material, and everybody's yelling for the hit that was number one 30 years ago. To be frank, I've been through the ups and downs with this. For a period of time after I first left politics, so the first few years after I left politics, and people would constantly talk to me about that speech. It coincided with the time that I was starting to travel internationally for various roles. Here's Julia Gillard, she's a former Australian Prime Minister, and immediately people would default to a discussion of that speech. And there was, you know, a part of me then that was, you know, oh my God, I was in politics for 15 years. I was deputy prime minister, I was prime minister, and it apparently all comes down to this one speech. And there was sort of a frustration about that. But I'm kind of through the other side of that now. And what's got me through the other side is that the misogyny speech has persisted, that it's found its new lease of life with younger women, and it seems to mean so much to them. And I'm still talking about it, particularly when I travel, but it's got to the stage now that women who talk to me about it, and some men, but predominantly women, you know, often the only thing they know about Australian politics is that speech, apart from kangaroos, koalas, sharks, spiders, snakes. It's basically the only thing they know about Australia. And I'm at peace now saying, well, look, if that's the one thing they know, I'm pretty glad it's that.
Yeah, and it's so, I think so few leaders are able to point to a big moment that is on video, that is, you know, 15 minutes long, that tells you so much more about you and what you did and what you stood for than just the content of that. That video, that clip, does so much more than just a debate about misogyny. It's also just, for people who enjoy watching great speeches and great moments in democracy, it's a great piece of drama. There's a human story there. It's almost like a film.
You know, our question time, our parliament is, I mean, we talked before, is there anything uniquely Australian about the sexism or anything like that? I don't think there's anything uniquely Australian about that. But one element of ours is we have taken the Westminster system and we've weaponised it. You know, our question time, our parliamentary engagements are much tougher. You know, we've had lots of, you know, when I was in politics, you'd have delegations of British MPs come to the Australian Parliament and watch question time, and to a person they would walk away going, what on earth. And we don't have this, you know, civilised, you know, Prime Minister's parliamentary questions, and they turn up every so often. You know, in Australia, you have question time every day. Parliament sits, the Prime Minister goes every day. You need to be in the back of an ambulance to not go to question time. You know, if you were overseas at the G20 or something, yes, you could miss a question time, but you know, you'd really need to be half dead otherwise you'd be hospitalised or something. It's expected that you go. The Prime Minister ends up routinely taking most of the questions, and it is the moment that the press gallery decides who's winning and who's losing. And so, you know, too much hangs on it, but sort of almost everything hangs on it in some senses. And so it is, you know, it is a gladiatorial sport. And I set out to show, because I think many people doubted, I set out to show that a woman could dominate in that environment, you know, that you could project force in the parliament and quiet it and kind of bend it to your will. And on my best days, I think I achieved that. But Tony Abbott, you know, I mean, people have their views about him, but in that sense, he was a formidable opponent. He's a very strong parliamentarian. And, you know, I think in that sense, you know, we were showing what it can be like when people are right out on the edge doing it. And there's a mutual respect in that, I guess, even as you are combatants, you bit like football teams going out, you know when you're playing against people who are highly skilled, and he was highly skilled, but I think on the misogyny day I came off the best.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure not just on that day, but do you think that had an effect on him? Did that? Did that make him think twice, perhaps, about his language and his behaviour? Has he ever said to you since, you know what, you were right about that? I've thought about that.
No.
I think I knew the answer to that question before I asked it, but just in case. And what was your relationship like? Did you have a kind of informal, you know, communication?
We had before. He had been Minister for Health for a period of time. I was Shadow Minister for Health, and whilst the health portfolio can be very politically contested, so we had some, you know, quite sharp encounters. We for a number of years were the sort of, you know, little Mr. Right, Ms. Left thing on breakfast TV. So, you know, we turn up at the same TV studio every Friday for what felt like forever. I can't remember how long it was now, but it's quite a long period of time. And so, you know, we sort of, you get to know each other that way. And, you know, in the health portfolio, there are a number of things that you do bipartisan together. So it's, you know, Heart Health Awareness Week or, you know, Diabetes Day or whatever. So you'll go out to a variety of functions together. And so, you, look, we knew each other quite well. But, you know, when it gets as willing as the contest was between us, and not because of the, I just want to be careful here, it's not because of the individuals we are. We were, the contest was about real things, you know, about climate change. Is it real or is the science cooked up? He would, you know, variously at various points would have said that the science was overstated. Should we have an emissions trading scheme? Shouldn't we? You know, the government's big reform agenda, it was in contest. So we were arguing over real things, even though the style of those arguments in Question Time can be very theatre-like. So as it got more and more brutal around that, it was obviously more difficult to sustain some underlying personal relationship.
And what about since, as two, you both former prime ministers, do you, you see each other at remembrance events or, you know, national things? How does that go?
Well, not as much as you might imagine. I've joked in the past, it's not like we go and, you know, hang out in a cubby together. There's no former prime ministerial cubby where we're all to be found hanging out together. You know, of course, I've run into Tony since, and I ran into him I decided I would exit politics in 2013. He was obviously, running to be prime minister in the election campaign. I ran into him in that context, actually, in an airport, he was, wanted to come and say hello, and so we did say hello. I mean, in part, I think because everybody around us was sort of staring, so, you know, the whole crowd seeing me, seeing him, and obviously thinking to themselves, "Oh my heavens, what's gonna happen next? Let's get some popcorn. You know, this is gonna be fantastic." We had a civilized, casual exchange, but I haven't seen him routinely in the years since. Obviously our paths are in different directions.
And as a former prime minister and former leader of the Australian Labor Party, you're free to kind of carve out your own post leadership life to intervene in national and international conversations as often or as little and in the manner in which you choose. How hard is it to be a former leader, someone who's held the highest office in the land, and have a relationship with your successors, particularly on the Labour side, particularly when Labour finds it hard to win? I mean, do you advise Albo, and have you advised subsequent leaders of the Labour Party, or do you make the decision that it's none of your business anymore and you try and keep out of it?
I took a firm decision when I left in 2013 that I would not be a commentator on Australian political debates any longer, and I have rigorously stuck to that. So I don't do media interviews about contemporary political debates. If Albo or anybody else in the Labor team wants my advice, they know where I am, they can ring me up, and I'm always happy to talk. But you know, that I, from, you know, different people will make different decisions, but for me, that's been the right decision. So, you know, I'm happy to talk to people. To the extent I have any of those conversations, I view them as confidential, and I don't, you know, there'd never be a day when you would see a TV story that says, you know, on X policy issue, Prime Minister Scott Morrison today said X, Anthony Albanese said Y, and Julia Gillard said Z. I rigorously make sure that does not happen.
And how important is it to you to tell the story of your, particularly the 3 years as Prime Minister, and for you to shape your own legacy about what happened in those 3 years? You know, you think of previous leaders that go and they think, well, the public will make their mind up. And sometimes I think the public can be left with the wrong impression of a leader, because if you don't defend your record and if you don't tell that story and if your allies don't tell that story, you leave your story in the mouths and in the hands of people that don't agree with you, and people within your own party, and people, the opponents on the other side of the house, that would or you know, naturally want to talk that record down anyway. So do you ever think, I have to sort of nurture my legacy of those 3 years? I need to just remind people what I achieved, and whether it's education or whether it's climate change, whether it's economic management, just periodically just tell the story.
Not really. I mean, I wrote, you know, the book, My Story, and, you know, that's my telling of the period and the things that we did and the things that we achieved and the errors we made, the errors I made. I tried to tell it, frankly, you know, all of it. There was the 10-year anniversary of me becoming Prime Minister in the middle of last year. And the Labor women's organisation, Emily's List, celebrated that with a series of social media posts and graphics about the achievements of the government I led. And obviously I was involved in that sort of social media experience, and Emily's List hosted an event with me to talk about the government I led, and Wayne Swan and Tanya Plibersek, who's still in politics, participated in that. So those sorts of things happen. But, you know, other than those quite, you know, big moments like the 10 years, I don't end up thinking about, you know, legacy shaping, and I don't, you know, I don't enter the public square if someone says, you know, someone was arguing the toss, a commentator was arguing the toss about our reforms in education or whatever, I wouldn't, you know, run into the public square to put the counter view.
You had 3 years as Prime Minister, which is not a lot of time. It must be, I mean, obviously it's a huge achievement to have ever led a political party, to have ever led a country. Now, these are just huge, rare achievements that so few politicians will ever achieve. But 3 years, there must be you must have felt at the end, for all the achievements, that you had so much more you would have liked to have done.
Yes, and I think, you know, there'd be very few people who exit politics without a wistful sense of, with more of an opportunity, I could have done this and this and this. But, you know, it is, you know, what's the best way of putting it? I do distinctly remember when I was packing up my office as Prime Minister, so I'd lost the Labor Party ballot. Kevin was coming back as Prime Minister. I'd said that if I'd lost, I would be exiting politics. I thought whoever lost the ballot should exit politics. And so I was packing up my Prime Ministerial office, so, you know, big cardboard boxes everywhere. And former Labor Prime Minister Paul Keating rings a sort of condolence call to, you know, see how I was feeling. And when I picked up the phone, his first words were, we all get taken out in a box, love. We all get taken out in a box. And you thought, gee, I feel so much better, Paul. I'm so glad you rang. but, you know, he was making the obvious point that if you put yourself forward for democratic politics, mostly people leave because they've lost an election or they lose a party ballot. Very few people exit because they retire at a time of their choosing under no pressure. And so if you are going to seek the opportunity and the huge privileges that come with it to put your values into action, then you can't quibble about the end. You can't mourn about the end because it's a package deal.
Do you miss it?
Oh, yeah. I miss some bits of it. I miss some bits of it desperately. You know, probably that's lessening over time, but there are some, you know, the opportunity to, you know, see a problem, think of a solution, put the solution into action, get the big things done. I'll never have more power in my hands than I had when I was Prime Minister to do that. So, yes, I miss that. I miss that sense of, you know, absolute camaraderie with the best of your colleagues under this intense pressure. And whilst I work with incredible teams now in the things that I do, it's not quite the same. I miss some of the adrenaline-fueled moments of it. But there are lots of things that I don't miss, you know, the relentlessness, the sheer relentlessness, the intrusion of the press gallery, of the media into personal life questions, you know. I've joked in the past, there's never been a morning when I've got up and said to myself, oh, you know, I really miss the Canberra Press Gallery. Oh, my Lord, my life's just, you know, bereft without them. I've never felt that. So, you know, once again, it's a mix. And, you know, you could spend a lot of your life running the what ifs and thinking about and what if I'd got more time and all the rest of it. For me, I honestly just don't live like that. I did it. I'm glad I did it. I'm proud I did it. I'm happy to talk about it. If there are things that can be learned from it that shape contemporary experience in a better way, and I think on women and leadership in particular, there are those things, then they're of importance to me, but I don't live in it.
You said you won't go back into Australian politics, but you were born in Wales. You renounced your British citizenship to go into politics in Australia. Could you not reclaim your British citizenship, come back here? You work in Britain regularly when you know, pre-COVID. Those days will return. Could you not come here and become the first female leader of the Labour Party and the first female Labour Prime Minister?
Given the politics in the UK are around accents with a voice like mine, I do not think so.
I mean, there's probably, isn't there? You know, you move into Australia as a sliding doors moment. Had you stayed in Wales, you could have become leader of the Labour Party here, perhaps.
Well, that's a sliding doors moment that we'll never get to live. I don't know, but something tells me I am on a different path from the one that you are outlining, and it would be very confusing for all concerned, wouldn't it? I can imagine all of these Londoners with very nice voices listening to mine going, heavens, she must be from very far up north to be speaking like that.
But you must have had a Welsh accent initially. I mean, do you remember hearing yourself with a Welsh accent?
No. I mean, my parents always had some Welsh lilt in their voices, but no, you know, I don't have a memory of, I don't have an original memory of being in Wales. I was too young. I mean, obviously I've been back since and we've got family and all the rest of it, but I don't remember it from my childhood. You know, my lived experiences of always being an Australian.
And you moved to
Australia. My remembered lived experience.
Yes. And you moved to Australia because of bronchopneumonia, and the doctor suggested that a warmer climate would help with that. Did it?
Really?
Are you cured?
No, I'm perfectly well, thank you. And I've got to be very careful telling this story because I get I've in the past had the Welsh tourism people raise these questions with me about what impression I might be giving people of the climate in Wales. So I don't want to get on the wrong side of any of that. It is true to say I had bronchial pneumonia when I was very small. And a doctor did say to my parents that I might do better in a warmer climate. But my father did joke that when he went back to the doctor and said that we were moving to Australia, the doctor looked a bit confused because he was thinking of somewhere like Cornwall. You know, he wasn't actually recommending a move to the other side of the world. So it wasn't the only reason we migrated.
No, I'm sure. I feel like I've kept you for too long already, but I did just want to ask about... We talked about climate change and COVID and all these other global things. One of the other issues is the influence of Russia in politics. Saw it in the presidential elections, in Brexit. Has there been much of it in Australia? Are you dealing with Russian bots and interference and the hacking of democratic institutions in the same way that we might be here in America?
Look, I'm probably not the best person to ask in the sense that the real analysis of all of that would not be made available to me in these times, you know, to the extent that our security and other agencies are looking at those sorts of things. But, you know, I mean, intuitively, I'd say it would be naive for anybody in any democracy to say that they're immune from these malign influences in democratic politics, the insertion of... nation state power from the outside through surreptitious means.
And Putin is a world leader that you met, had a quite surreal experience with him where he effectively announces to the world the passing of your father, which is
yes, he did. I don't hold that against him. I think there are many reasons many people should hold many things against him, but I don't hold that against him. It was I was at APEC. Russia was chairing it. So President Putin was chairing it. At the last minute, I had to withdraw from the meeting and get back on a plane to get back to Australia because my father had died. And so in the making of these very quick arrangements for the trade minister to sit in for me, I think, you know, he was announcing to the other leaders why I wasn't there, and I think was just doing that genuinely and with a sense of compassion that I'd had to go because of these family circumstances.
So, because Putin is one of those people that I think because of the way he is and the way Russia is, you always presume there's some sort of Kremlinology behind it, like it's some sort of move. But obviously, he's still a human being and will make mistakes and will do things sometimes with good intent. I mean, just broadly on Putin, did you get the sense in your sort of limited exposure to him that he was someone that was perhaps prepared to come in from the cold at all?
No, I mean, my memory of him is of the sort of ultra... macho demeanour that you see across the television screens and a very checkerboard analysis of the world. You know, it was either Barack's, he would say, meaning President Obama, it was either Barack's or it was not, this kind of view that, there was the US and then there were the other places and the places where potentially Russia could have influence. So, a very checkerboard view of the world.
So looking forward now, I mean, you're still young. You have
Thank you for that.
Well, it's true, certainly in political terms, although I didn't want to put that caveat on it immediately. You know, you look around at world leaders, Joe Biden, who's just got elected at his ripe old age. You still have so much more to achieve. I mean, you might not go back into elected politics, but what about something like a role at the UN? What about Secretary General?
Oh no, I've defined the path I'm on, and this is what I want to do. When I left politics, I spent a lot of time. I mean, you got to kind of grieve out the loss a bit. So I did that. You got to get yourself healthy and well again because it takes it out of you. And as I went through all of that process, I thought, you know, what do I want the next bit of my life to be about? And I decided I wanted it to be a mix of things, a portfolio of things. I'd obviously lived with the, one big job, one big role kind of pressure. I wanted it to be a portfolio of things that I was interested in, believed in. And so I've put that portfolio together, and it means that I get to, remarkable organisations like the Wellcome Trust, building the Global Institute for Women's Leadership. You know, my passion is around these sorts of issues and causes. And, you know, I don't want for opportunities, and I'm very, very happy with the mix that I've put together. It's not in me to say, look, you know, I'm really doing this now, but I'm aspiring to X or Y or Z beyond it. That's not how I feel about it. This is exactly what I want to be doing and putting these years into.
Well, people will follow your work at King's College and the work you did in Australia and at the Wellcome Trust. I mean, all these roles you've got in Britain, it's a heck of a commute.
Well, particularly now, I mean, you know, when you come out of Australia, you're kind of used to long plane rides. None of that worries me. It's a heck of a commute, but, you know, I'm used to it.
Julia, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Well, there you go, Julia Gillard. What a brilliant way to celebrate 200 or thereabouts episodes of The Political Party. And that feels like one of the interviews where you come away and go, I've learned something there that I could actually apply in my own life. We could all write down our purpose in a new job especially and keep it on hand. That's just a really good nugget to have, a tool to have that would improve your life. And there is something about people who've run countries, and it's obviously the elite level of leadership. So they have a different perspective on leadership. And even just about, not just the decision to effectively reinvigorate the cabinet after the way that Kevin Rudd had run his government, but also about how a prime minister behaves in a cabinet meeting and when to speak and when not to. And I wonder if our current prime minister has a similar philosophy. You know, you start to think, well, I wonder if they did that, and I wonder if they did that, about different leaders, not just in this country, but around the world. But the pressure of leadership, the importance of being on top of it, because otherwise you effectively get swamped by the system. The pressures on our leaders are incredible, and the pressures on women leaders even more so. And the misogyny that Julia suffered whilst Prime Minister, and before and after, really is off the scale. A lot of that is documented in a fantastic book, My Story. I've put a link to that in the blurb so you can buy that, as well as Julia's new book. And I've put a link to the King's College research from the Global Institute of Women's Leadership, Essays on Equality, so you can read all that. Julia's autobiography is the single greatest prime ministerial autobiography I've ever read, or I think by any politician's autobiography. There is nothing else like it out there. It reads like a film. So I've put a link to that so that you can buy that and read that, because it really is an incredible story. And of course, what's also fascinating is life after leadership, and that if you think of our prime ministers in the UK and how Gordon Brown's approach to life after office, and Tony Blair's, John Major's, Theresa May's, and David Cameron's are all different. Let alone different party leaders like Ed Miliband or Neil Kinnock. They all go in a different way. They carve that out for themselves. And Julia obviously is carving out, because she is young for a former world leader. There's so much life left for the world to benefit from all her expertise and experience. So I'm always interested in what people do next and the decisions they make about whether to get involved, not, and when and how. And who knows? It sounds like it won't happen, but maybe Julia Gillard will come to the UK and become our first ever female leader of the Labour Party. I might not put money on it yet. I very rarely bet. And it turns out I'd be right to, because perhaps that would not be the best use of a quid. But what a fantastic guest. What a treat. I hope you enjoyed it. 200 or thereabouts episodes of The Political Party. Thank you for downloading this. As always, tell your friends, spread the word, share it online. And if you can find it, if you can find a second in the day to go on the Apple Podcasts app and leave a review, I would be very grateful. Happy 200. I don't think there's a kind of... I mean, 250 would be a quarter millennium, I guess. I don't think there is a word for 200, is there, apart from 200? So happy 200 episodes. In 50 episodes' time, I may well be doing a happy 250. But let's see. I shall leave it there for now. Thank you for downloading this. It was, as you can imagine, I'm a huge fan of Julia Gillard, so getting to interview her was a real treat. A brilliant guest. And hopefully, as always, a bit of escapism from the things that are going on in the world. And I'll see you next week. Ta-ra.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.